Hello, and welcome to the Reconstruction.us podcast, the place where people from all walks of life discuss what we can all do to transform America into a more equitable nation and ourselves in the process. My name is Kimberly Miller, and I am the host of this show, as well as the website Reconstruction.us, where you can find articles and essays by myself and others who are deeply concerned about the state of our nation and are committed to making real change. Well, as we record this interview, it's the end of 2020, and everywhere I look, there are people wishing this year good riddance. It's been tough for everyone and devastating for thousands of American families who have lost loved ones to the coronavirus. Thanks to the tireless work of some incredible teams of scientists, two vaccines have been released so far, and already over 2 million people have received a dose in this country, a sign of real hope. These vaccines were brought to market in record time. In fact, it may be that in the long term, the biggest impact will be the revolution in research science that made this unprecedented speed of its release possible. Today's guest is Dr. Thomas Hartung. He is the director of the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, CAAT, a laboratory for developmental neurotoxicity research based on genomics and metabolomics at Johns Hopkins University. Hartung has been leading a movement within the world of research to move away from animal testing and utilize new technologies that can lead to faster testing on humans and then to market. I've asked him to join me today to share his insights on this revolution in a field that has been highly reliant on old methodologies. And welcome. We are so thrilled to have you here today, Dr. Hartung.
Thank you very much, Kim, for having me.
Well, I was wondering if perhaps you could kick us off with just letting us know kind of what the status is. We've got 2021 right around the corner, and I know that you've been deeply involved in generating these new vaccines. What can you tell us about the current status in the U.S. and globally?
I think the miracle which happened over the last year is that we have three vaccines already, which have got a nod somewhere in the world. Only today, it was the third vaccine, which came from AstraZeneca and Oxford University, which was accepted in the UK, and we expect this to follow suite.
And that's so just today, a third one.
Just today, a third one.
Wow, I did not realize that was happening. That is tremendously exciting.
Yeah, and it's a very important addition to the portfolio because this is one which does not need to be cooled. So it is only 1/10 of the costs. This is extremely important for the rollout also into developing countries, but also rural areas in the US, for example. Mm-hmm. And it shows that not only one, not two, but three development projects were possible in less than a year, getting us to regulatory acceptance.
Incredible.
I'm a pharmacologist and toxicologist, so I'm interested in two things. I'm interested in getting new drugs done, and I'm interested in making them safe. Normally, to get a new vaccine is more than 10 years of work, sometimes 18 years of work to get a new vaccine accepted. So imagine this. And nobody knew about this. It is exactly 1 year ago that China informed the World Health Organization there's a problem. 1 year ago. And science has delivered. Science has delivered these vaccines, but it also has developed several treatments. The response by sheer numbers is incredible.
Yes, it really is. It's phenomenal. I think, frankly, it shocked many people who, even when we heard, well, it's moving pretty fast, you know, I'll be honest, I took that with a grain of salt because I'm old enough to know, hey, they've got to work on it for years, they've got to test animals, they've got to then people, et cetera, et cetera. So what made this possible?
First of all, we were prepared. Science has developed. If you compare when HIV came up in the 80s, it took us about 4 or 5 years until we knew what the virus is. In case of this virus here, we had not only the virus identified, but the whole genome of this virus was sequenced already on the, I think on the 11th of January this year. So just about 2 weeks after the WHO was alerted. And on the 17th of January already, we had the first PCR reaction to identify patients outside of China, which came in this case from Germany and became the WHO method. So imagine in 2-3 weeks, the system responded and made diagnostics available, created the tools that we could actually start developing drugs against it. Yeah.
Fantastic. And I understand that your organization has been deeply involved in another aspect of this revolution. And I'm going to call it that because I think certainly in the from what I know of the field of science, being a lay person, this is pretty revolutionary. And as I understand it, a lot of your work has been around leveraging new technologies as an alternative to animal testing. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. This has been my specialty, you could say, over the last 30 years. And I was first responsible in Europe for the evaluation, validation, and promotion of methods which can replace animals. And then in 2009, I moved to Johns Hopkins, where I'm directing the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. And you have to understand, I'm a physician. A physician in the leading school of public health. You hear Bloomberg School of Public Health at the moment everywhere. My work is about improving the situation for patients and consumers. But I want to do this with the least suffering of animals. Also because they're simply a technology of the last century. I always say we are not 70 kilogram rats. And we are certainly also not 70 kilogram cell culture. We are something which is very complex, but we have opportunities with modern technologies, computer-based, new cell culture, where we form little organs, tiny little organs. We can do something which is much better than a mouse or a rat is reflecting us.
Yeah, I had to laugh when you said we are not 70 kilogram rats because, last time I checked, I never felt that way myself. I think that's really an important point because certainly in my generation, we were all educated to believe that it was very valid and very valuable to use animals for any kind of testing first and for an extended period of time in order to make it safer for human testing. But in reading some of your articles and I'll confess, I watched a couple of YouTube videos last night and saw a couple of your lectures. And I noticed that, frankly, I was shocked at how poor the rates actually were for effective use of animal testing. Can you educate me and our audience more around why you see animal testing as such a poor choice at this time?
I mean, first of all, science is developing quickly. Yeah? We saw this in COVID. We are now approaching 100,000 scientific articles about this in only 1 year. We always say that the knowledge we have in the life sciences doubles every 7 years. Most of the animal tests we use in the development of more of even in the safety of drugs, they have been introduced when I was not yet born in kindergarten. And I'm now 57 years old. So imagine, yeah, this lack of evolution of science is unheard of. And simply because we wanted to believe that these animals give us the right answers. But they're wrong in both sides. Yeah, they are wrong in missing things. About 1 in 10 drugs has to be taken from the market afterwards because of usually side effects, which were not known. They also sought out stuff which would be a wonderful therapy. I once wrote an article showing that aspirin would not make it to the market today because it failed several of the standard tests. So you have to imagine, yeah, we have a situation where we use the wrong tool because it is not humans. A rat, a mouse, they get about 2.5 years old. They don't have to worry about the diseases of old ages, about the chronic effects of certain substances. They very often don't have the defense for these because they don't live that long. Mm-hmm. These are some reasons why we are not doing good service to the industry and not to the patients in the end by overly relying on animal testing. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that struck me as well in your presentation was the huge numbers of animals that are still being used for traditional kinds of testing. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm saying this wrong, but your work has been in the field of testing toxic chemicals. Is that correct? Or can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what kind of mass numbers of animals we're actually talking about?
Yeah, the numbers are not so clear in the US because we don't have statistics.
Okay.
This has to do with our animal welfare legislation from the 60s, which simply says at the very end, animals are not, in the sense of this legislation, mice, rats, and birds, which simply excludes some 85% of all of the laboratory animals from any animal welfare protection, but also from all statistics.
I didn't realize that. So we're not counting.
We're not counting.
Yeah. Okay.
Europe is counting very well. So Europe is using roughly 12 million animals in the labs every year. People have estimated that it is about 17 million probably in the US, which are being used. That's certainly a pretty good estimate. The important thing is that if you want to avoid using animals, you need to have something better.
Yes.
Or at least something equivalent. And there's at the moment two major developments which really made this possible. One is that we get access to human cells and can produce little organs from it. And this is a dramatic scientific revolution because it's so recent. It started in 1998 with human embryonic stem cells. Because you have to imagine, it is almost impossible to get human cells of good quality. You get some blood, you get perhaps some skin, but then it stops. Yeah, I'm interested, for example, in the brain. I don't get brain donations easily, and that's certainly not regularly enough to run experiments. You have to imagine, to get cells from a human was always limited to surgery taking place, but then you have to compete with the pathologist who wants the material which is taken out. And there's a reason why the patient was operated. You don't get healthy material, really. But with stem cells, suddenly it was possible to get started. And the first line of development was ethically problematic because it used surplus embryos, which were not used for in vitro fertilization, with consent of the parents. It's not difficult to say parents for something which is less cells than what you have under your fingernails. But it is indeed a material which was ethically concerned for many. But in 2006, so just 14 years ago, Yamanaka developed the technology to reprogram human skin and make it a stem cell. This got him the Nobel Prize in 2012, because only since then we really can produce essentially every tissue, every type of cell in high quality and very reproducibly by basing this on this development.
So could you describe for us a little bit more about how this works? As I understand it, I mean, this is amazing. There's no question about it. And I think it's important for people to be able to have a deeper understanding of what that actually means. Because you and I are pretty much the same age. And I mean, when I think of working with cells, I still think of petri dishes. But what I understand and from your work is that that's really old news, that we're working with a very different kind of chip technology. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, you're now describing all of the cutting-edge developments. The classical cell culture is still broadly used, And it makes sense often to use these simple systems. Because they're cheap, they don't require a lot of skills to run. They have become routine now. What we are now using is in the leading laboratories really some technologies which allow us to reproduce an organ. And I explain you how the process is, and I take the example of what we are working on, which is the brain.
Okay.
My lab is interested in whether drugs and chemicals like pesticides, industrial chemicals produce in the end autism. So developmental neurotoxicity, we call this, is the development of the brain impacted by these substances, and an explanation why we see this incredibly rise in autism cases. In the US, we have now 1 in 59 children being born with autism. So that's enormous. In
the 70s,
this was hardly around. Mm-hmm. I cannot study this in mice and rats because they don't live long enough. I have never seen an autistic rat. Yeah. So it is really difficult to produce something like this in an animal. Mm. So we need some human brain samples. No way. Taking a brain tumor has very little to do with the brain. So we had nothing until really the stem cells came over. Now we can take these cells, and I can take them for myself, for example. I can take a little piece of skin and reprogram them to become a stem cell. The advantage is I know all my disease history. I have different diseases. For example, I have not had autism, so I'm probably not carrying the risk genes for autism. And with this characterization, I already know a lot about the material, which I typically don't know about others. And then I go further and use these stem cells, which I produce and can freeze and can use them endlessly in my laboratory. I use them to produce brains. These brains are tiny, tiny, tiny. They're the size of the eye of a housefly. So you can just see it, which is a very big advantage. I can take them and can move them. But they're so small that they're not really ethically problematic. This discussion about can they become conscient or whatever. That's less brain cells than or neurons, as we call them, than an insect has. Yeah, mm-hmm. So you cannot expect them to really develop something. And we can produce different parts of the brain. We can follow the development towards the brain, and we can then see where the chemicals interact. Or, in our case, COVID-19. So whether the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is responsible for the disease, can infect our mini brains. And this was the big news from our laboratory in June this year, that we were the first to show that actually this virus is infecting human brain cells. It has led to a lot of interest from the Financial Times to everything. We had more than 200 articles about this, and I've been a frequent speaker at some conferences to get this message out, because it explains some features of the disease which are really worrying. Yeah.
So is that the cause of what I've read about with like a brain fog that some patients get when they're infected with COVID-19?
Yes, indeed. This is a possible explanation why so many patients develop neurological symptoms. Already in the first studies in February in Wuhan, we learned that 36% of their patients had neurological problems, which was...
Wow, 36%.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah, and some European studies from summer this year have numbers up to 60%, yeah, of some patient groups which were showing neurological problems. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of reasons why the brain is not functioning properly. It can be the massive inflammation. It can be lack of oxygen because the lung are not functioning properly. But it can also be direct infection. And that's an important difference, however. Because while the lung, if you survive, will get back to normal, while inflammation somewhere stops and the brain works fine again, you don't know whether the infection of the brain will ever end. Because right. the immune system, which is helping us to get rid of a virus, does not touch the brain. We call this immunoprivileged. So the brain is an organ which is typically not attacked by immune cells because it cannot repair, it cannot really regenerate. So this is the reason why, for example, HIV, you get rid of it in all of your body with the modern drugs. They're gone. There's not a virus which you can identify in the bloodstream, no organ but the brain. And as soon as you stop taking your pills, the virus comes back out of the brain because that's the site which has where we cannot eliminate it.
I did not realize that. So even if we take a vaccine that allows us to have a clean bill of health, if it affects the brain, that disease is going to stay there, is what you're saying.
Yes, they're typically persistent because there's no mechanism to get rid of the virus. And it's also extremely difficult to get drugs into the brain. We have something which is called the blood-brain barrier.
Yes.
Which protects this very precious organ against a lot of things from the environment. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, sometimes also from the drugs we want to get inside. So if this is the case, you have to imagine what are the consequences. It means that you had the disease, but it's not over. You might have problems 10, 20 years after. We know that virus infections of the brain, for example, fuel Alzheimer development. A very important concern. Can you, for example, really do volunteer studies where you infect volunteers after vaccination with a virus, which then possibly stays in their brain for the rest of their life, impacting on diseases further on? So it's an extremely right. important thing to study. Yeah?
I totally agree. And I have to tell you, on a very personal level, this is something that really scares me about this virus, because I work in the healthcare field. And so, you know, I'm working with folks who are getting tested and we don't know yet if they're positive or not every day almost. And it's one thing, I have concerns about, am I going to survive if I were to be infected? But even if you survive, but then, you know, you've got continuous issues that are going to affect your ability to think. And, you know, that's a quality of life concern as well. So I'm really, really glad to hear you addressing that so directly, and that they were able to identify this concern so quickly. That sounds like a huge leap as well.
Yes, indeed. I believe that our results are setting an alarm, a flag, that something needs to be done. And this, first of all, shows that these alternative methods, alternatives to animal testing, they are enabling technologies. You could not have shown that the brain is a possible target of this virus in mice or rats, because no cell of a mouse or rat, not even the lung, is susceptible because they simply don't have the proper receptor. On the other hand, I'm not saying we have already shown that in patients, the brain is a major target of infection. I don't say we will have an epidemic now of Alzheimer because we have this additional risk factor. No, but it's an alert which can now be followed up clinically. And some of this has consequences. And to give you another example, we are mainly interested in the development of the brain of an embryo. It has already been shown that the virus passes the placenta barrier. There's good reason to assume that it passes also the blood-brain barrier in the embryo. There's some results in this direction. So it could easily impact on brain development. And this means we would have to really protect pregnant women in a completely different way than we do at the moment. We really have to do much more to avoid any infection taking place. Because what most people don't see, the most babies of the pandemic are not yet born. They're embryos.
Right.
And we know that it is not an infection which normally leads to abortion, leads to a spontaneous abortion. I mean, because it is not dramatically impacting, for example, on brain development. But if it is somewhat impacting, and some virus infection are risk factors, we might see another increase in the autism rates. And we can diagnose autism only after some 18 months to 3 years of development of a child. So we will only learn with very much delay whether we see further rise in these cases to which the COVID infections could contribute. Yeah.
So I think this is incredibly important to emphasize, and I really want to help you get the word out about this, because as I'm sure you're aware, there are a number of people in the United States who are what they call anti-vaccine. And a lot of the fear around that is around testing and whether vaccines have been effectively tested. I know certainly the negative comments I've seen around the coronavirus vaccine and people who are saying, I'm not going to take it. You know, there's a real fear that it could be damaging. But what I hear you saying is that actually, because of this new technology, it's not that we're testing it for the first time on the first people who take it. It's really that you have found a much better, more effective, and more efficient way to be able to bring a vaccine to market, because we are doing that pre-testing on human cells as opposed to human beings. And I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about why this is so, or, you know, how much more effective this is, because some of the data that you presented around the difference between the effectiveness of testing with animals versus what you were finding with the chip technology, I was really, really kind of amazed by.
I mean, first I should say it was not me helping the testing. If you say we, it is the
okay, the royal scientific the royal. We. Yes,
I'm a opinion leader in the field of getting these. We call them microphysiological systems. So it's micro, very small, but producing the physiology of an organism. So all of the back and forth of interactions which we have. And I'm at the moment organizing a world summit for this. And we are working with the FDA and others on these topics and their quality. And so I'm pushing this technology in very general terms. And I just gave you an example with our mini brains, where we are also impacting on some aspects of this disease. The important thing is it takes you for a comprehensive safety assessment 4 or 5 years for a chemical. And even to get into humans, it is quite a package. And all the pharmaceutical companies had to take shortcuts to get there. But shortcuts which were not endangering the first people which tried this. And we have seen each of these vaccines has been tested on roughly 30,000 people. 30,000
wow.
people already.
Okay.
And they were closely monitored. Mm-hmm. We heard even twice about halting these trials because there was a single person showing a possible problem. If you recall, there were news about this. Yeah, mm-hmm. It is a very careful process. These things are safe. And to say it simple, I cannot wait to get a vaccine into my arm. I don't worry which of the three it will be, mm-hmm. Because this is an investment into my personal safety, which is a very good trade-off. Sure, nothing is risk-free. I can have an allergic reaction to whatever constituent of a vaccine. But we know how to treat an allergic reaction. There have been some reports on anaphylactic reactions, yes. But these were people who had anaphylactic reactions to other things before, and we know how to treat it, but we don't know how to treat COVID-19.
Right.
And it's very few.
Right.
It is really a very rare event that something is happening here. We don't have any reason to assume that there's more reactions than, let's say, for flu vaccination. Mm. So I really believe that this is a very important measure. And I tell my own mom, turning 80 next year, as soon as possible here. Shout loud that you want to get vaccinated. And this is because we have a really reliable system. And this system is very immune against political influences. You've seen how the FDA was going through its processes, and it did not bother that there were politicians shouting, you should have this before the November election out. No, it needs to be evaluated properly, because only then you can safeguard the quality and can give the people the trust into what is happening.
Well, Dr. Hartung, I have to tell you, I can't help but think about this on a personal level, as well as, you know, with the more the broader kind of social world that this podcast talks about. Because as much as I really do trust the scientists, as an African American, you know, with some of the history of using and abusing African Americans and in history with various kind of science experiments, you know, this is back a couple of generations ago, but the memory is a long-term organ, if you know what I'm saying. And there's a certain amount of mistrust that we tend to have because of the past. And I have to honestly tell you that after studying more of your work and in our conversation today, I feel safer now that I understand how much research has really gone into this. I feel more confident this morning about getting that vaccine myself. And I mean, like I said, I'm exposed to people, you know, 5 days a week. So it matters for me in terms of urgency. So I want to, on a personal level, just tell you that I think the more we can really try to educate the general public about how this technology works and why you're able to champion these alternatives, it can be incredibly valuable. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, because the focus of Reconstruction is really around trying to help support, educate, champion, analyze the work of leaders in all kinds of fields who are seeking ways to create really a better world and strengthen our country in a more equitable way. And I thought a lot about, frankly, for me, how impressed I was by your success and your organization's success. Because let's be honest, you're really trying to move a battleship in a hurricane when it comes to, you know, the bureaucracy of the FDA, the bureaucracy, that's probably not the right word, but the very traditional commitment that science research has had to animal testing. I mean, PETA's been around for what, 30 years now or something, and we still haven't made much movement in the United States until now. And so I was wondering if you could perhaps share whatever lessons you have gleaned or what you have found to be effective in trying to really help a very, let's say, committed ideology to help that change within a field like the sciences and research science in particular.
That's a lot of questions you have put in.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No. But I think it is really important to realize it is, on the one hand, it's about good science and allowing the best science to get into use. But it is also a societal problem, the communication problem. I've been working on policy scientific policy advice, working for the European Commission. My job was to help them to get the right science into legislations. And working for them, I understood I have more impact by informing policymakers, by creating alliances of people, than by making my next scientific paper, which nobody reads and some people cite. It is really important that we scientists find a way to impact on the necessary decision-taking And this crisis is a very good example. There is a lot of crap around, yeah? And if we don't speak up, if we don't help people to sort what is valid, what is reliable, and what is not, this is extremely dangerous. Because wrong decisions are taken, the wrong people voted into offices. I'm so proud that the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health has been an institution, really a lighthouse in this storm, as you described it, because it has been signaling here we host the reliable information for the world about this pandemic. That's an extremely important part of it. In the longer term goal of moving us from a science of the 19th or 20th century using animals, something really which became popular exactly 100 years ago, yeah, to something which is modern technology relevant and is extremely important. But we must not forget, it's not only about the safety of the things. We have to address health equity aspects. We have to reduce the different levels of information people get. And we have to fight also the tribal communication, which we are seeing with Facebook, where people get completely different sets of information depending on which group they belong.
That's absolutely right. I know I'm not new in saying this by any means, but it is really hit a crisis level in terms of the how much, certainly here in the United States, but it's not just in the U.S. Literally, we have people living in two different Americas. In terms of being able to completely isolate yourself in either bubble, right? If I'm watching Fox News every day and I'm listening to Rush Limbaugh and I'm kind of in that world, then I'm getting those feeds, I'm getting that anti-vaccine kind of information and a lot of fear mongering, or I'm sitting over watching, you know, CNN or whatever I'm watching, and I'm getting all kinds of science, and I'm want to get a Anthony Fauci T-shirt, right? now, of course, we want to get a Hartung feet T-shirt, but there's such a completely opposite. And what I'm trying to say is that the views are coming from somewhere. They're not, people aren't making this stuff up. And they feel very strongly because it's being reinforced either way, right? Whichever megaphone, so to speak, I'm listening to. So are there some ways that you have found to be effective in trying to kind of bridge that gap? It sounds like one is speaking with policymakers. What else would you recommend?
I mean, from our own experiences, the most important thing is to speak with everyone and not support this divide. We are working with the PETAs and Physicians for Responsible Medicine, call them these organizations, but we are not an animal welfare organization. We're working with the industry and we're talking also to the people who defend animal experimentation. Because in the end, I believe we can, on the basis of facts, come together. It's ethically, it's very difficult. Most scientists and also most people in society have made their decision. I'm in favor of animal experiments or not, and very few change sides. It's more a generational change, which is giving more rise to the anti-animal experimentation side. But if you start talking about the economics, what does it cost to get this information? How long does it take to get this information? Then it's changing. And this is why I have very early on said, wait, COVID-19 will be a door opener for new approaches. It's because, very simple, we cannot do the job with the traditional paradigm. We cannot wait some years for the data package in animals if we want something in months on the market. And if we can do it here and we show it's successful, why can't we do it for other types of medicines?
Absolutely. Could you give us some of the numbers in terms of costs? when we talk about the benefits of going away from animal testing and using this new technology, some of the stats that you cited that really jumped out at me were the differences in terms of efficacy that I mentioned before, but also just the cost savings. And when I was listening to some of those numbers, I thought, wow, where could that money be used if we weren't having to spend it on testing millions of animals? So can you share a little bit more of that detail with us?
Sure. I mean, animal experimentation is very expensive. You would be surprised. A single rat is about $30 if you use it in the lab. And then keeping it, feeding it, maintaining it, all of the infrastructure makes this really a very expensive commodity. A chimpanzee is more than $150,000, yeah, under these circumstances. So we're not fortunately not using them to a large extent. But it means it's slow. And it's expensive. It is not always human relevant. So there's good reason to look into things which are fast because you do it in very small things. Sometimes the whole workflow can be done by a robot. It is really an explosion of knowledge and of information which we get from the new technologies. And one area of our work which we have not touched on is artificial intelligence and computational methodologies. There you only press a button. Yeah. And we had a big hit in 2 years ago with a model which we developed in a computer model for which we showed it is doing its job better than the animal test in finding toxic substances.
How much better?
We showed that the animal test, if you repeat it, found 81% of the bad substances. We found 87%. So really a clear-cut difference. And we showed this for 190,000 situations where we had a chemical and a toxic effect. Can you imagine? So it was really, it's without doubt. So this is why we got press on this the same day from Nature and Science, the leading scientific journals. They covered us in the day we published our findings. Yeah. And these methodologies essentially cost nothing. You press a button and within a second you have the results. They don't work for everything, but we showed that they could outperform 9 different animal tests, which are consuming in Europe more than 500,000 animals per year and cost about $300 million.
And you can do that now in a push of a button. Yeah. Wow.
These are the simple tests, I have to admit, and they don't help us with cancer or whatever. Yeah, but it is a first step. And it shows that you can dramatically reduce the cost, the time. And this is really often important. Let's take an emergency situation. You might recall this chemical spill we had at the Elk River some 5 years ago, where I think some 300,000 people had no water supply for weeks of the chemical. The only information for this chemical, which was used in millions of gallons, was a single test in rats, exposing these rats acutely to the substance and following them up for 2 weeks. That's all we had. No idea otherwise about their toxicity, what to expect in humans. And then having tools at hand which can give you a profile by pressing a button is incredibly valuable. Yeah.
This is phenomenal. Well, again, thank you so much for your time. And I wonder if perhaps you could share with our audience how they could get more information about your organization and about your work.
Yes, absolutely. Our center is having a newsletter, for example, which is directed towards a more general audience also, where we have a lot of links then if for those interested in details. You find our website, CAT at Johns Hopkins, very easily, just entering this into Google or any search engine, and can subscribe to our newsletter. My name is quite not unique, but rare enough that I show up first in these searches. So don't hesitate to shoot me an email and I will integrate you into our information.
Great. And that's Thomas Hartung, H-A-R-T-U-N-G, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. And it's 2ACAAT is the acronym for your website?
Yes,
okay.
The Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, CAAT.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you again. I really congratulate you on this phenomenal success. And I have no doubt that it's going to really revolutionize things moving forward. So thank you for all your hard work. And I'm sure many sleepless nights to get us to this point.
Thanks, Kim, for spreading the word.
This brings us to the end of this week's episode with re-construction.us. Please join us next week or visit our website anytime, where you can find more interviews with activists and leaders from all over the country who are committed to making real change. Thank you and have a great day.